Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation is trying to determine the motive of the gunman who opened fire on two military facilities in Chattanooga, Tennessee, Thursday, killing four U.S. Marines. The FBI's Ed Reinhold said in a news conference that there is nothing now that ties the shooter, identified as Mohammed Yusuf Abdulaziz, to terrorists, international terrorists. VOA's Sharon Bain reports.
I'm here in Chattanooga, Tennessee, the small middle America town that yesterday suffered through a series of shootings. A young man, Mohammed Yusuf Abdulaziz, took a gun and drove by this Army recruiting center where he shot in the windows and then further went to another military facility and killed four Marines. This is a town that's in shock today. There are people coming, they're putting flags, they're showing their sadness and grief over what happened. And I think there's some people who are definitely angered by what happened. I spoke to an older man this morning who is also a resident here, and Ed Reinhardt, and he said there's a certain group of people here that tend to get radicalized, a sort of indication of the Muslim population that lives here. But others like Gwen Ott, whom we also spoke to, who came to place flags at the memorial this morning, her attitude was, no, we have to all try to live together.
That was VOA Sharon Bain reporting from Chattanooga, Tennessee. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has called last year's downing of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 a ruthless terrorist attack, said the fatal missile shot that could only have happened with participation from Russia. Mr. Poroshenko said Friday Ukraine's moral duty to honor the victims is to ensure a fair punishment for those responsible for shooting down the aircraft. This is VOA News. The Obama administration is continuing efforts to sell the Iran nuclear agreement to skeptical allies as diplomats move ahead with preparations to ratify the deal in the UN Security Council. President Barack Obama will meet Friday at the White House with Saudi Foreign Minister Abdel Al-Jubeir, whose government has expressed alarm about the deal with regional rival Iran. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met Thursday with Jubeir, who did not explicitly endorse or reject the Iran nuclear accord. The historic nuclear deal, reached last week between Iran and six world powers, is expected to be approved early Monday by the U.N. Security Council in Vienna, according to diplomats. More bomb blasts Friday have interrupted Eid celebrations in northeastern Nigeria, killing at least 10 people in the city of Tamaturu. Two explosions struck an open-air praying area where worshippers were observing the final day of the holy month of Ramadan. Some reports say there was another blast following the first two. No one has claimed responsibility yet for the attacks, which follow twin blasts in the town of Gombe Thursday. At least 50 people were reported killed in that attack on a crowded market, with customers doing some last-minute shopping on the eve of the Eid al-Fitr festival that marks the end of a month of fasting. The vice president of Yemen's exiled government says Saudi-backed troops have recaptured the southern port city of Aden from Shiite rebels. Fighters loyal to the exiled government launched a major offensive this week against the Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Aden, Yemen's second-largest city. The Houthis seized Aden in March, forcing the government of President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi to seek refuge in neighboring Saudi Arabia. Saudi-led coalition of Arab states has since carried out 3 months of devastating airstrikes on the Houthis, helping lead to a major humanitarian crisis. The German parliament voted overwhelmingly Friday to open negotiations with Greece on a third bailout package. Lower house lawmakers supported the government proposal, 439 to 119 votes and 40 abstentions, to launch talks on details of the rescue plan. Germany, as the largest contributor to Greece's bailout, has been insisting on drastic spending cuts and tax hikes in return. Eurozone finance chiefs agreed Thursday to hand Athens a short-term loan to meet its immediate debts and also open talks on a new three-year, $94 billion bailout, which would be the country's third in 5 years. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Supporters of Egypt's outlawed Muslim Brotherhood group clash with police in several suburbs of Cairo Friday on the first day of a holiday to mark the end of Ramadan. Police say at least six people died in scattered violence.
That's Edward Yerenian reporting from Cairo. Details coming up. Also in the news, more bomb blasts today have interrupted Eid celebrations in northeastern Nigeria, killing at least 10 people. And amid a renewed State Department warning of possible terrorist attacks in Kenya, President Barack Obama heads to East Africa next week. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour, more bomb blasts today have interrupted Eid celebrations in northeastern Nigeria, killing at least 10 people in the city of Damaturu. Two explosions struck an open-air praying area where worshippers were observing the final day of the holy month of Ramadan. Some reports say there was another blast following the first two. No one has yet claimed responsibility for the attacks, which followed twin blasts in the town of Gombe yesterday. At least 50 people were reported killed in that attack on a market crowded with customers doing some last-minute shopping on the eve of the Eid al-Fitr festival that marks the end of a month of fasting. The blasts resembled attacks carried out by Boko Haram Islamic militants who have killed thousands in a six-year insurgency in the country's northeast. There has been a spike in attacks by Boko Haram after a four-nation coalition of Nigeria, Niger, Chad, and Cameroon pushed out the militants from captured territory earlier this year. The violence has further intensified since Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, took power 1.5 months ago and vowed to crush the group, something his predecessor also had made a priority but failed to do. Earlier this week, Mr. Buhari replaced all of Nigeria's military chiefs in another step aimed at halting the Boko Haram insurgency. Supporters of Egypt's outlawed Muslim Brotherhood group clashed with police in several suburbs of Cairo today on the first day of a holiday to mark the end of Ramadan. Police say at least six people died in scattered violence. Edward Yerenian reports from Cairo.
Amateur video showed small groups of young men throwing stones and shooting firecrackers at police outside Cairo near the Grand Pyramids of Giza. Police appeared to respond by firing tear gas. Egypt's Interior Ministry claimed that armed individuals fired live rounds at police from a bridge overlooking the street where clashes took place. VOA could not independently confirm the source of the gunfire. Witnesses say protesters were trying to block traffic on a main boulevard near the pyramids, but police prevented them from reaching the area. The Muslim Brotherhood group reportedly urged its supporters to demonstrate against the government to mark the end of Ramadan. Egyptian security forces appear to be on alert in many places to avert any violence. Police set up checkpoints on main roads and bridges and searched suspicious vehicles. A rash of suicide car bomb attacks across the Arab world is forcing stricter security measures in many countries. Hilal Kashan, who teaches political science at the American University of Beirut, tells VOA that Egypt has fought Islamic militants several times since the 1950s, but tackling just the security conflict without solving underlying political tensions will leave the country fragile.
If the government is eventually successful in bringing about calm, be it artificial or real, I think the country will pay a very heavy toll for restoring calm.
Islamist President Mohamed Morsi was ousted by the military in July 2013 following large popular protests against his rule. An operation to disperse two protest camps of Morsi supporters in August 2013 provoked a simmering conflict between the Muslim Brotherhood and the military. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The vice president of Yemen's exiled government says Saudi-backed troops have recaptured the southern port city of Aden from Shiite rebels. Fighters loyal to the exiled government launched a major offensive this week against the Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Aden, Yemen's second-largest city. The government announces the liberation of the province of Aden on the first day of Eid al-Fitr, said Vice President Khalid Baha via Facebook today. The Houthis seized Aden in March, forcing the government of President Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi to seek refuge in neighboring Saudi Arabia. A Saudi-led coalition of Arab states have since carried out 3 months of devastating airstrikes on the Houthis, helping lead to a major humanitarian crisis. Amid a renewed State Department warning of possible terrorist attacks in Kenya, President Barack Obama heads to East Africa next week with counterterrorism high on the agenda. VOA correspondent Aru Pandey has more from the White House.
During his 2013 visit to Senegal, South Africa, and Tanzania, President Obama announced initiatives boosting U.S. cooperation in trade, investment, and infrastructure on the continent. Mr. Obama says his trip to Kenya and Ethiopia is aimed at sending a similar message that the United States is a strong partner, not just for the two nations, but also for sub-Saharan Africa.
Build on the progress that's been made around issues of health and education, focus on counterterrorism issues that are important in East Africa because of Al-Shabaab, and some of the tragedies that have happened inside of Kenya.
The U.S. president's first visit to his ancestral homeland comes amid continued deadly attacks in Kenya by Al-Shabaab, and just days after the reopening of Nairobi's Westgate Mall, where militants gunned down 67 people in a 2013 siege. Counterterrorism factors into Mr. Obama's visit to African Union headquarters in neighboring Ethiopia, the first visit to the East African country by a sitting U.S. president. Jeffrey Smith with Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights says the U.S. sees Ethiopia as a key ally in the region, particularly in the fight against Al-Shabaab.
And Ethiopia is really seen as a bulwark against that, not only in terms of regional cooperation, but contributing troops to AU peacekeeping missions as well across the continent. So in that regard, and particularly their role in the Sudan crisis, the South Sudan crisis, their role is sort of being seen as a regional mediator.
But Smith says President Obama's visit sends the wrong message, citing Ethiopia's repressive regime.
What many people don't know is Ethiopia is the fourth most censored country in the world. They're the second largest jailer of journalists on the entire continent, second only to Eritrea, their next-door neighbor.
Atlantic Council's Bronwyn Bruton, who has met with Muslim democratic activists in Ethiopia, some who were recently found guilty of terrorism, also calls President Obama's trip a mistake.
The fact that Ethiopia is getting a visit from President Obama in the wake of that guilty verdict and in the wake of sweeping the elections, taking 100% of the seats, sends a disastrous message to the Ethiopian government.
A senior Obama administration official tells VOA the United States regularly communicates its human rights concerns with the Ethiopian government, both in public and in private. The official says, quote, "We engage so that we can urge and shape behavior in these areas." Aru Pandey, VOA News at the White House.
Nearly 25 years after being overthrown, former Chadian President Hissène Habré goes on trial Monday, July 20th, on charges of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and torture. The trial is being held in Dakar, Senegal. Habré had the support of the U.S. and France when he came to power in the 1980s to help counter Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. Human Rights Watch was instrumental in gathering evidence against Habré. Reed Brody is the group's counsel and spokesperson from Dakar. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua about the former president of Chad and his pending trial.
Hissène Habré was the dictator of Chad from 1982 to 1990, and he's accused of massive political killings and a systematic torture, in particular waves of repression, first in the south of Chad in 1984 against Christian communities, then in 1987 against the Hadjerai ethnic group, then 1989 against the Sahawa ethnic group. And we happen to stumble on the files of Habré's political police, the DDS, which was his principal arm of repression. And in those files alone, we were able to count the names of 1,208 people who were killed or died in detention, of almost 13,000 victims of arbitrary arrest and torture. And that's just, we believe, a small part of what was going on in the country. It doesn't include the many villages that were burned down in the north and east of the country during the ethnic campaigns and in the south. He was finally overthrown, Habré was, in 1990 by the man who is still president 25 years later, Idriss Déby, and Habré fled to Senegal, where he has lived ever since.
Now, of course, this was 25 years ago that he was overthrown. Why has it taken this long to bring him to trial?
Well, it's really been what Desmond Tutu referred to as a legal and political soap opera. Habré was overthrown in 1990. In 1999, after the arrest in London of the Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet on a warrant from a Spanish judge, when the British House of Lords Judicial Committee ruled that Pinochet could be prosecuted anywhere in the world, despite his status as a former head of state, people around the world and the Chadian human rights groups in particular said, well, wait a second, this means that we can try to bring Hissène Habré to justice. And we were approached at Human Rights Watch by the Chadian groups. And actually, they filed a case here in Senegal in 2000, and Habré was arrested for the first time in 2000. But then politics entered the picture. Habré, before he left Chad, emptied out his country's treasury and used that money really to build a network of influence in Senegal, particularly or under the previous president of Senegal, Abdoulaye Wade, essentially blocked the course of justice for 12 years. And it wasn't until a new president was elected, Macky Sall, in 2012, and also the International Court of Justice in The Hague, in a case brought by Belgium where the victims had also filed complaints. The International Court of Justice ruled that Senegal had to either prosecute or extradite Habré. And so in 2012, after 15 years of mobilization, the ICJ decision and the election of Macky Sall opened up the way for the victims to finally find justice here in Senegal.
He's being tried before what's called the Extraordinary African Chambers in the Senegal court system. Can you give us a brief description of what that is?
This is a hybrid court established by agreement between Senegal and the African Union. Essentially, it's a Senegalese court, but where the top officials, the president of the trial court, eventually the president of the appeals court, are non-Senegalese from other African countries. So the presiding judge is from Burkina Faso. And in many ways, the best of all worlds, because it's both a Senegalese court and an African court. It follows the mandate of the International Court of Justice, but also a political mandate of the African Union to bring Habré to justice in the name of Africa. It's the first time, in particular, that victims, that survivors themselves have mobilized to create the political conditions in Africa to bring a dictator to justice.
Is this expected to be a long trial?
The trial is expected to go about 3 months. It's really, in a way, a low-cost tribunal, $10 million compared to, you know, $1 billion for most of the international courts. We're expecting about 100 victims and witnesses to testify, and it's expected that the trial would be over by the end of October.
Reed Brody is counsel and spokesperson for Human Rights Watch from Dakar, Senegal. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua. 20 past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A panel of six UN experts have urged the UN Security Council to take action in Burundi against politically motivated violence or risk a major regional conflict. The appeal released by the UN's Human Rights Agency warns that the UN's highest body must take decisive action before the current level of fighting leads to wholesale atrocities. More than 80 have died in clashes between police and demonstrators in Bujumbura, the capital, since political opponents of President Pierre Nkurunziza protested his bid for a third term in office. The election is scheduled for July 21st. The authors cited evidence that members of the ruling party's youth wing, the Imaboni Rakura, are the main threat in the conflict. They say the armed militia has conducted extrajudicial killings of civilians with the collaboration of the government. Given the ethnic violence that has plagued Burundi and the region in the recent past, the UN officials called attention to the increasing potential of an escalation of massive violence. More than 150,000 have fled the country. The army has killed 30 and arrested more than 100 suspected rebels in the north of the country. Regional and international voices have been unsuccessful in urging a peaceful resolution to the electoral controversy. This September will mark the end of the UN Millennium Development Goals and the beginning of the Sustainable Development Goals. One of the proposed 17 goals calls for ensuring healthy lives and promoting well-being for all. One NGO says achieving that will require innovation. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
The international nonprofit organization PATH has released its Innovation Countdown 2030 report. PATH Senior Program Officer Claudia Harner-Jay says the report highlights proven or promising medical technologies.
It is a PATH-led initiative that's working to create a platform to identify and assess and then showcase high-impact innovations that can accelerate progress towards these new global health goals that are included in the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals.
The technologies include drugs, devices, vaccines, and diagnostics.
Are we talking big money? Well, we're talking, I think, big innovations. I think it really depends on where they are in the stage of development. So there are vaccines that are showcased, for example, that still need a lot of development dollars to move forward. There are also later stage innovations that still have challenges in really getting out there for true impact.
Harner-Jay says one of the technologies featured in the report is a small-scale water treatment device.
There's an innovation that's highlighted there called the Zimba, which is an automated batch chlorinator that was actually developed in India. And it's a rugged device that fits directly on a hand pump or community tap that can then automatically chlorinate water.
There are 30 innovations listed in the PATH report, such as neonatal resuscitators to help newborns breathe better, handheld blood pressure devices to detect possible complications when a woman gives birth, and new formulations of the powerful pain medication oxytocin to control bleeding after childbirth.
We conducted health impact modeling for a select number of innovations in the maternal and child newborn health space this year, and we used key model drivers like coverage and the availability and use of an innovation in a given setting, and then also effectiveness. And then we also estimated the lives saved based on a number of assumptions that, again, relate to how an individual seeks care, obtains that health care intervention, and so on.
PATH also highlighted HIV, malaria, and TB vaccine candidates, rapid TB diagnosis tests, training lower-level health workers to diagnose and treat diabetes, and portable and affordable screening for such eye problems as cataracts and glaucoma. There's also something called a uterine balloon tamponade.
That is a simple, low-cost kit that consists of a condom that's tied to a catheter, and then it's inflated with clean water through a syringe and a one-way valve. And that, again, is used to manage postpartum hemorrhage, which is the leading cause of maternal death.
The UN summit to adopt the post-2015 development agenda will be held from September 25th through the 27th.
We actually looked at innovations that can accelerate progress towards the Sustainable Development Goal number 3, ensuring healthy lives and promoting well-being for all ages. And then the very specific health targets are pretty much mortality endpoints. So they include things like reducing global maternal mortality by less than 70 deaths per 100,000 live births, or ending preventable deaths of newborns and children under 5.
Harner Jay says PATH is engaging entrepreneurs, investors, innovators, and experts to raise awareness about health innovations and get them on the market. She says while 30 innovations are highlighted in the report, many others were submitted to PATH. The organization intends to feature them through what's called an Internet Data Visualization Tool to allow the public to see them and understand how they work. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Medical researchers and scholars from 13 sub-Saharan African countries have yesterday wrapped up a three-day conference in Zimbabwe to share insights and success stories on applied innovations to address HIV and AIDS. Sebastian Mumfu has more details from Harare.
The conference enabled medical researchers and scholars from across Africa to exchange notes on what is being done to fight the spread of HIV on the continent. One of the major highlights of the conference was a revelation that the number of medical graduates in HIV/AIDS is increasing in Africa. The chairman of the conference, Professor James Hakimu, said a lot had improved since the introduction of antiretroviral drugs in Africa.
However, AIDS remains a disease that requires lifelong treatment. We still do not have any cure. Although there are many research programs that are looking for cure, there is none. So it is extremely important that we must continue to emphasize prevention. But one new realization is that treatment with antiretroviral drugs is not only therapy for those who are infected, but it also protects others.
Africa bears the biggest effects of HIV, with more than two-thirds of global infections being on the continent. Professor Hakimu said that explains why the United States, through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, provided $130 million in 2010 to support activities of the Medical Education Partnership Initiative for 5 years. He said the program ensures innovations to address HIV and AIDS in Africa and ensure an AIDS-free generation. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyi Suwuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
On Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best. Right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. More bomb blasts today have interrupted Eid celebrations in northeastern Nigeria, killing at least 10 people. Amid a renewed State Department warning of possible terrorist attacks in Kenya, President Barack Obama heads to East Africa next week. And nearly 25 years after being overthrown, former Chadian President Hissène Habré goes on trial next Monday. Coming up, music from Ghana. And in our feature segment, we look into how Western influence manifests itself in the lives of Africans today. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sonny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. Hello, Sonny.
Happy Friday, Yehiyas.
Sonny, I understand you are beginning with basketball.
Yehiyas, let's tip off with pro basketball and a big game in Africa. Joining us now with more details is VOA's Tadi Abeje. Sporty greetings, Tadi.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. The National Basketball Association and the NBA Players Association have announced the rosters for the first ever game to be played in Africa on August 1st. There will be two teams, Team Africa and Team World, competing at the exhibition contest in Johannesburg, South Africa. Miami Heat small forward and South Sudan-born star Luol Deng will be the captain for Team Africa. Los Angeles Clippers point guard Chris Paul will be the captain for Team World. The head coaches are San Antonio Spurs head coach Greg Popovich, who will coach Team Africa, and Brooklyn Nets head coach Lionel Hollins, who will coach Team World. To promote the game, Luol Deng appeared in an NBA video. Let's give it a listen.
Luol Deng, going to it for Miami Heat. The NBA Africa Game 2015 is on August 1st in Johannesburg, where Team Africa will take on Team World in the first ever NBA game in Africa. And I was born in South Sudan in a town called Wau, which is a 16-hour drive from the capital, Juba. I would never have dreamt that one day I'll be playing in an NBA game in Africa.
Nope. And the follow by Luol Deng.
Basketball is it's a growing sport. It's an international sport. It's just touching so many different parts of the world now. A lot of people in Africa have always been passionate about it. And growing up, they never had the chance to watch basketball. And now they have the chance to do so and be more involved with the game and follow it. Just an amazing thing, and I'm glad that the NBA is doing its part to get the people in Africa engaged and encourage them to take part of the game.
That's Luol Deng, the captain of Team Africa on August 1st in Johannesburg. The African-born players on Deng's team are Congolese center Bismack Biyombo of the Toronto Raptors, Senegalese center Gorgui Zhang of the Minnesota Timberwolves, Nigerian center Festus Azili of the NBA champion Golden State Warriors, and Cameroonian forward Luke Richard Baamute, who is currently a free agent. The charity game will help raise money for Boys and Girls Clubs of South Africa, SOS Children's Villages of South Africa, and the Nelson Mandela Foundation. The game will be broadcast live in the USA on ESPN television and in Africa on SuperSport. I'm VOA's Tadi Abeje. Back to you, Sonny.
Thank you, Tadi. There should be lots of excitement surrounding the NBA's first game in Africa on August 1st. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver will attend the game in Johannesburg, along with two NBA greats from Africa who are now retired, Hakeem the Dream Olajuwon from Nigeria and Dikembe Mutombo from the Democratic Republic of Congo.
This is Dikembe Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
Hey, g'day, mates. Remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right. Give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively sunny man on the sunny side of sports, right here on the Voice of America.
This is Larry Zamude, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner with VOA. VOA! And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9 Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to sports radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman, Marco Uma, joins us now with more sports news.
We begin with athletics. Ethiopian Shuru Bulo clocked a world-leading time of 9 minutes and 1.12 seconds to win girls 3,000 meters at the IWF World Youth Championships in Cali, Colombia on Wednesday night. Kenyans Emily Chebet Kipchumba, then Sheila Chelangat, followed Bulo across the finish line. In Monaco, a showdown in 1,500 meters pitting Somalia-born Mohamed Farah of Britain, Kenyan Asbel Kiprop, Morocco's Abdelati Igida, and Algerian Taufik Makloufi look set to be the highlight at the IWF Diamond League in Monaco today, Friday. Botswana's Nigel Amos, Kenyan David Rudisha, and Ethiopian and Mohamed Aman face off in 800 meters. South African Louis van Zyl and Tunisian Mohamed Segaia contest 400-meter hurdles as Kenyan Julius Riego competes in javelin. Nigerian Blessing Okagbare Igoteguonor and Kenyan Eunice Sum contest the women's 200 meters and 800 meters respectively. Ethiopian Genzebe Dibaba and Kenyan Mercy Cherono clash in 1,500 meters. As women's 3,000-meter steeplechase features Morocco's Salim El Ouali, Algeria's Amina Betis, Tunisian Habiba Gribi, Ethiopian Hiwota Eleu, and Kenyan Virginia Nyambura. In cricket, Namibia play Papua New Guinea at the 2016 ICC 2020 World Cup qualifiers in Dublin, Ireland tomorrow, Saturday. On Sunday, Namibia tackle Hong Kong, while Kenya play Netherlands in Edinburgh, Scotland. In football, Rwanda's military side APR play Sudan's El Shandi. Zanzibar's KMKM face Djibouti's Telecom as Tanzania mainland's Young Africans encounter Kenya's Gor Mahia at the start of the Council of Eastern Central Africa Football Association's CECAFA Kagame Club Championship in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania tomorrow, Saturday. On Sunday, Burundi's LLB engage Somalia's Hegan. Ethiopia's Adama City plays South Sudan's Malakia as Tanzania mainland's Azam face Uganda's Kampala City Council Authority. Finally, Mali play Canada as Egypt face China at the start of the Women's World Under-19 Basketball Championships in Chekhov, Russia tomorrow, Saturday. On Sunday, Mali engage Belgium as Egypt challenge Spain. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend.
The Voice of America, VOA.
I believe that children everywhere should be free to grow to adulthood in health, peace, and dignity.
Pledge your support for children at www.gmfc.org.
Saturday is Mandela Day, an annual international day in honor of the South African freedom fighter who died in 2013 at the age of 95. To mark the occasion, I've been invited to be a panelist at Frederick Community College in Maryland, the venue for what promises to be an exciting, enriching, and yes, sporty program of Mandela Day activities. My topic, Mandela and sports as a cultural conduit for unity. Regarding that topic, Nelson Mandela said, and I quote, Sport has the power to change the world. It has the power to inspire. It has the power to unite people in a way that little else does. It speaks to youth in a language they understand. Sport can create hope where once there was only despair. It is more powerful than government in breaking down racial barriers. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Abel Udo Ekene Jr., a proud 2012 graduate of the University of Uyo in Nigeria, sent me a pleasant Facebook message. Abel says he's celebrating a birthday on this Friday, and he's wondering if he can get an official Sunny Side of Sports birthday shout-out. You got it, Abel. Happy birthday to Abel Udo Ekene Jr. in Nigeria, one of my Facebook friends. The VOA's Tadi Abeji mentioned Cameroonian forward Luc Richard Bahamute as one of the African-born players who will be competing in that NBA game on August 1st in Johannesburg, South Africa. Earlier this week, Luc signed a one-year contract with the Sacramento Kings, but the Kings voided the contract after Luc failed a team physical. We wish Luc the best as he tries to sign with another NBA club. I talked with Luc by phone earlier this year in his role as a spokesman in Africa's fight against the deadly Ebola disease. Another African athlete who has joined in that fight against Ebola is Sierra Leonean striker Kai Kamara of the Columbus Crew. And I want to give Kai a Sunny Side of Sports shout out. The 30-year-old Kamara is leading Major League Soccer in scoring this season. Kai bagged his 13th goal of the season Wednesday night in the Crew's 1-0 victory over the host Chicago Fire. In the 41st minute, Kamara converted a crossing pass and headed home the game's only goal. It was the first road win of the season for Columbus. Kai Kamara began his MLS career with the Crew in 2006, and then he played for three other MLS clubs before Columbus brought him back this season. Kai Kamara also plays internationally for Sierra Leone, and I know he wants that team to get back to success after this big fight against Ebola. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to you, Hayes Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny, and thank you, Tadi Abeji. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, we talk to a reporter on international dating. And next, we look into how Western influence manifests itself in the lives of Africans today. But first, some music. Here's Rocky Dawuni of Ghana with African Reggae Fever.
Yezwa yemichana so yechu
kose
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 siyelela
siyelela
tina
tina
lusapolwayo.
African reggae fever, catch it, catch it. There will be no cure when you get it. Hey, you Mr. DJ, play it, spread it. It is the common man's time now to make it.
This one is for the rockers from Accra to Kingston.
It is the common man's time now to make it. Have
to listen to what I have to say. Redemption through music, my only intention. Bringing hope to places while their leaders laugh and play. From Accra to Soweto, all I hear is more fire. Youth in the ghetto now desire more fire. Music on the radio, don't take them no higher. It's too late, none of them can stop us now. African reggae fever. Catch it, there will be no cure when you get it. Hey, you Mr. DJ, play it, spread it. It is the common man's time now to make it. From Accra down to Lagos to Addis Ababa. It is the common man's time now to make it. Out of many, come together as one. They gone down all our heroes in a cold-blooded murder. Try to stop this movement from going much further. Jah Jah give us power to cross every border. Hey DJ, press rewind and come again. African reggae fever, catch it, catch it. There will be no cure when you get it.
Rocky Dawuni of Ghana with African Reggae Fever. If you are in Uganda, what's the least attractive quality for a potential first date? Or as a tourist in Myanmar, what's the worst way to meet a girl on the street? To answer these questions and others you may never have thought to ask, VOA's Heather Murdoch talked to an international dating culture reporter.
Matthew Stein, a Canadian journalist in Uganda, publishes datingcultures.com. Here are some of the titles of his past video reports.
There was street flirting in Yangon, Rwanda's wet and wild tradition, gay all the way in Bergen, Norway, on stage at a Ugandan sex show, and of course, sex-bushed.
In the sex-bushed videos, Stein asks people on the street questions about local dating customs, offering small cash prizes, about $4, to winners.
Third question for $10,000. What would make somebody unacceptable for a first date in Uganda? A, if they're poor, B, if they're ugly, or C, if they're a smoker.
In Uganda, apparently smoking is the least attractive quality in a first date, according to a local survey. But some shopkeepers in the video object, saying poverty is a much bigger problem than smoking when it comes to dating. In this video from Myanmar, Stein tries to meet women on the street.
You drink beer or coffee? Can we meet sometime and have a drink together?
No, sorry.
No? But even later? Tonight or tomorrow? Weekend?
Sorry, no.
Sorry, you're not free?
Yes.
You're so free. I'd like to meet you.
Thank you.
He is turned away by young women, explaining they don't go out at night because their culture demands obedience to their parents, who wouldn't approve. Stein says his material uses humor and a universally held interest in romance to draw people's attention to related issues they otherwise may not think about.
If I were to publish a story about Ugandan politics, that would only appeal to so many people. But if I use dating, which is a more universal subject, I think more people will watch, and in the process, they'll be exposed to other issues in that country that they wouldn't normally see in a two-minute news report.
For example, other articles on his website about Uganda talk about abuses towards gay and transgendered people and women's rights. Dating Cultures videos have been filmed in roughly a dozen countries on four continents. The project used to be called Erotic Routes, a name creators recently abandoned because of complaints that it could make people think of pornography rather than cultural exploration. Stein says talking about sex or romance publicly in many of the countries he works in is often considered taboo. In his opinion, it shouldn't be.
I think it's a very important thing to talk about in countries where people are not able to talk about sex and their sex life. There's a whole bunch of problems that manifest itself, from STDs to teenage pregnancies.
And while these are serious consequences, he and his team hope to chip away at these taboos with jokes. Articles, videos, and international guides in the works also seek to encourage cross-cultural dating, Stein says, and prepare daters for what they may encounter as they travel the globe. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
In the late 1800s, Europeans partitioned and colonized most of Africa and brought a new way of life to the continent. As Africans became more exposed to Europe and North American customs, Western culture was regarded as the only authentic civilization. African ways of doing things were seen as primitive. So how does Western influence manifest itself in the lives of Africans today? VOA's Alma Zabedje spoke to some Africans living in the USA and has the story.
A Ghanaian teenager sporting cowboy boots in Accra, a Kenyan woman surfing the web at an internet cafe in Nairobi, a Nigerian girl wearing a Chelsea jersey in Lagos, a South African athlete styling and profiling in Air Jordan boots, all too familiar scenes in many parts of Africa. They're also demonstrations of the all-pervasive Western influence on the continent, especially its youth. Damacy Fawole attends school at the University of Georgia in Athens. She is of Nigerian descent. Damacy believes there are both benefits and disadvantages to Western influence on African culture.
A positive aspect of Westernization is definitely the encouragement of the arts and humanities in Africa, because I think historically Africans have felt pressure to go into certain fields that aren't really necessarily creative, but they're job secure and things like that. Historically, you didn't see a lot of music and fashion, but it's coming up now and people are being more creative and expressing themselves in different ways. A negative thing is the language aspect, because most countries in Africa, the official language is English, but it's also important to keep those indigenous languages that they have, especially the ones that aren't written, because in schools and the educational system, they're discouraging the use of indigenous languages and they're encouraging English.
That was Nigerian-American student Damacy Fawole of the University of Georgia. Asifash Makanen is a graduate of Vassar College in the U.S. state of New York. She is of Ethiopian ancestry. Asifash maintains her indigenous Ethiopian name and has not adopted a Western nickname, as of many of her friends. I asked her why.
I was named after my mother's mom, and so part of the reason that I've felt really close to this name is because a reminder of her, because she died before I was born. So this is a way of constantly keeping her in my life and keeping that generation of my family in my life.
Ethiopian-American college graduate Asifash Makanen of Pelham, New York. Nathan Ohini is a high school student in Annandale, Virginia. He is of Ghanaian descent. He says Western influence has been detrimental to Africa's cultural development.
I feel that it has had a harmful effect because the West has made Africans feel inferior. From the very beginning, when they started to imperialize the continent, they killed the people and enslaved them. That's why it was difficult for them to feel their own culture had value. They portray us as like poor and starving, and they also try to portray us as very violent in all the movies like Blood Diamond.
That was Ghanaian-American high school student Nathan Ohini. Esther Gitui Iwort is a Kenyan-born broadcaster here at The Voice of America. As a legacy of British colonial rule in her country, she has a European Christian first name and an African last name. Esther doesn't feel having a mixed European-African name diminishes her cultural heritage.
I think it goes with the kind of the life that I live in, the contemporary life that I live in now, because I do want to assert my faith in my name. I don't think it's Western. I value my African culture as I do the Western culture, but I have to strike a balance between the two. I think I get the value of having good qualities from both of those cultures.
Kenyan-born VOA broadcaster Esther Gitui Iwort. The debate over Western influence on African culture dates back to the late 19th century, but with the advent of the internet, social media, and increased travel, that debate is becoming less relevant. Cultures today intermingle at a level not seen before, and technological advances appear to accelerate their interaction all around the world. This is Alma Zabedje, reporting for VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
In a further sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of the Middle East and Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on four key leaders of the terrorist group ISIL, or Daesh. With roots in a 1990 jihadi group, ISIL has dramatically undermined stability in Iraq, Syria, and the broader Middle East, posing a threat to international peace and security. It has recruited thousands from across the globe to fight in Iraq and Syria, committing gross, systematic human rights abuses, including mass executions, persecution of individuals and entire communities on their identity, killing and maiming children, rape, and other atrocities. ISIL claims to be the true heir of Osama bin Laden's terrorist legacy. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information on Abd al-Rahman Mustafa al-Qaduli, up to $5 million each for information on Abu Mohammed al-Adnani and Tarkan Teuma Razovich Batirishvili, and up to $3 million for information on Tariq bin al-Tahar bin al-Fali al-Awani al-Harzi. Al-Qaduli is a senior ISIL official who, when released from prison in 2012, traveled to Syria to join an ISIL network. As a member of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or AQI, he served as its leader Abu Masab al-Zakari's deputy and as its emir in Mosul, Iraq. Al-Adnani, whose birth name is Taha Sobi Falaha, is a senior ISIL leader and its official spokesman, the main conduit for disseminating ISIL messages. He has repeatedly called for attacks against Westerners and has vowed defeat for the United States. Batirishvili has served as a senior ISIL commander and Shura Council member. He has overseen an ISIL prison facility in Al-Tabqa, where ISIL possibly held foreign hostages, has worked closely with ISIL's financial section, and has managed ISIL operations in the Manbij area of Syria. Al-Harzi was one of the first terrorists to join ISIL and has served as an ISIL official operating in Syria. He has helped to raise funds from Gulf-based donors and was recruited and facilitated the travel of ISIL fighters. He was named its leader for the border region between Syria and Turkey. He also has served as chief of ISIL's suicide bombers. The United States guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the United States is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have such information, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate, the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net, or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.